My fellow plebs, River is setting a new standard in Bitcoin. At river.com, you'll pay zero fees when you dollar cost average. Truly the best way to build your Bitcoin wealth. All Bitcoin at River is held in secure cold storage with 100% full reserves. There's no need to wonder what's happening behind the scenes. Your Bitcoin is your Bitcoin to withdraw at any time. Additionally, River lets you make Bitcoin payments via the Lightning Network, offers a Lightning integration for developers, and allows you to mine Bitcoin directly to your River account. River has a level of service that is unheard of in this industry, including phone support, private client advisors, and the ability to designate beneficiaries to inherit your Bitcoin wealth. River has become the premium name in Bitcoin that anyone can easily access. Sure, you have a place to buy Bitcoin, but have you tried River? See and feel the difference at river.com and the River iOS app, the preferred partner of Bitcoin Magazine.
Imagine having $1 million and access to Samara Alpha's signature seeding platform to turbocharge your Bitcoin fund. You don't have to imagine anymore. You can really have it. It's called the Bitcoin Alpha Competition. Bitcoin Magazine Pro and Samara Alpha have teamed up to discover emerging Bitcoin fund managers ready for the global stage. If selected as a finalist, you'll be invited to attend the Bitcoin Amsterdam conference, where the winner will be announced. This isn't just about the prize. It's a chance to change the way investing works and to connect with a community of Bitcoin investors, builders, and leaders. Applications must be in by July 31st. Applying is simple. Go to www.b.tc/conference/bitcoin-alpha and fill out the simple form to enter the competition today.
Over the last 5 years, the Bitcoin Conference has become the world's largest gathering of Bitcoiners. From breaking announcements and international media coverage to countless meaningful talks by thought leaders and industry innovators, we are excited to continue our drive for global hyper-Bitcoinization. From July 25th to the 27th, 2024, we'll be taking the Bitcoin Conference to the city of Music and Freedom, Nashville, Tennessee. Join thousands of attendees for countless opportunities to learn, engage, and network across 3 days of pure Bitcoin signal. Get your tickets now for the best price at b.tc/conference. You are not going to want to miss what Nashville has in store.
What is up, everybody? Welcome back to FedWatch, your source for everything Bitcoin and macro. My name is Ansel Lindner, and I am joined once again by my co-host, CK, back from his world travels. How are you doing, CK?
Feels good to be back, Ansel. Man, it's been way too long. I'm sorry to have abandoned you for over a month, but what a day to come back to the show. A lot of breaking news to cover, a lot happening in the macro sphere and in Bitcoin per usual. And like Ansel said, this is really, it's still, you know, the formula has been out for several years now, but this is still the only show that really covers macro in a thoughtful, accurate, and intelligent way and incorporates the reality that is Bitcoin into that analysis. So thanks to Ansel for doing most of the heavy lifting, but I'm happy to be back. Of course, I would be remiss if I didn't talk about Bitcoin Amsterdam. I will be there October 12th through the 13th. It's going to be an absolutely incredible event. The website is starting to get really filled out with some awesome content. So go to b.tc/conference/Amsterdam. You can check out the venue. You can check out the offerings for VIPs, for GA, for business. You can see our initial speakers, which are looking really freaking awesome, very spicy. A lot of great speakers and a lot more awesome news to be announced. So the most influential and biggest event in Europe is coming back to Amsterdam. Be there, or are you even a Bitcoiner? I don't know. You can use promo code BMLive for 10% off. But Ansel, any housekeeping for you?
Well, just the topics up front that we're going to cover, guys. Of course, US CPI came out this week. That's the big story. And as CK was saying there, we have been very accurate on this show for the last couple of years. We have stuck to the transitory call on inflation, and now we see CPI coming back down. So we're going to go through a bunch of charts, look at what we can expect going forward. Macro charts, some of the macro things are shifting under our feet right now, like the dollar. We have supply chain stuff that is pretty much gone. We're going to cover a couple charts like that. So just a few pieces on the chessboard of macro are moving. So we're going to cover all those. Bitcoin inflows, the price of Bitcoin, of course, we'll cover that. Well, and then we'll I have some highlights from the Loomis bill. It has not, I haven't had time to digest it. I think it just dropped this morning, right? So I took some highlights that I found and we're going to cover those. But we have breaking news. Should we start with the breaking news, CK?
Yes, sir. Let's jump right in.
All right. So the first bit of breaking news this morning is the first spot Bitcoin ETF has been accepted by the SEC. This is not an approval. This is just an acceptance. That means the clock now starts for the 45 days. We have 21 days for comments. And then the SEC has the rest of that time. What would that be? 24 days to come to their decision. But 45 days now, the clock has started for Bitwise. This isn't BlackRock. So why is it out of order? We don't quite know. But a lot of people are saying that this is not going to affect the order of approval. Just maybe they split it up into different teams. This team is going to accept this filing. This team is looking into this filing. And this team just happened to finish first, the Bitwise team. So that's what we have going on this morning for Bitwise. Any comments on the ETF? All this happened while you were away. So do you have any?
I can jump in high level on my thoughts on the ETF. But before that, I want to kind of go back to you, Ansel, and let's zoom out and tease out what this Bitwise acceptance means. So quick question, has a Bitcoin ETF application been accepted by the SEC ever before this?
Yes. Yeah. This is in the normal process. What they do is you file, the SEC accepts it, then the clock starts, and then you either get approved or denied. So the big thing last week was, or 2 weeks ago now, I think, when they returned the applications or the filings, returned them back to the individual companies, and they had to refile with this surveillance sharing agreement and more clarification on that. So that was the first time that has ever happened, where it was returned before they even accepted it to start the clock. Now they have accepted this one from Bitwise. I'm guessing throughout today or tomorrow, we'll get more acceptances from all these other ETFs, but that means the clock is starting 45 days.
So really what's happening here is this is actually not anything new. This is really just this current cohort of applications. The Bitwise application was the first to get accepted. Yes. And what are the implications of that? Seems like not that much. And does that mean that they will be approved and the ETF will happen? Absolutely not. There's no guarantee of that. And if anything, the precedent is that they will reject it after pushing it off to the last minute.
Yeah, they have, I think it's they can delay for 45 more days, then 90 days, then 60 days. So a total, they can push it off for 240 days until they have to completely deny something. So this starts the clock. If you go forward 240 days, we're still before the halving, most likely. So all of these ETFs will have to be decided before the halving, which is a kind of interesting
tidbit. Is that bullish? Is that bullish or bearish for Bitcoin price around that time frame?
Extremely bullish. I mean, if it gets approved, right? I had a theory right when the BlackRock thing came out, CK, that this wasn't really a pivot by BlackRock, that they actually were trying to suppress Bitcoin by getting it denied, which I guess that's still in play, file for this. And if BlackRock gets rejected, that means nobody is ever going to get a Bitcoin ETF. That would be extremely bearish, I think, for sentiment in the space. But I don't think that's the case now. That was just one of my initial game theory, playing it out. What could they be doing here?
But, so yeah, continue.
No, I was done with the ETF. What else you got?
Well, no, I was going to ask you, I want to keep digging into this because I've been listening to a lot of commentary about this. Obviously, I haven't really given my own commentary, but honestly, I'm kind of curious now. Have you heard of this kind of theory that BlackRock and the SEC are a little bit in cahoots around suing Binance, suing Coinbase, kind of giving Coinbase a slap on the wrist and making that not an issue, and then all of a sudden all of these ETFs are using Coinbase and a surveillance sharing agreement with Coinbase. Is there some coordination there? Is that a West versus East type of a dynamic playing out? What's your interpretation of, let's just say, the uncanny set of events that kind of happened back to back? It's tough to think that's just a coincidence.
Yeah, I I think it's more than a coincidence, but maybe not quite to the level of outright conspiracy or collusion going on. So, I mean, they're all buddies. People worked for BlackRock and they go to the SEC or vice versa. So they all know each other. They probably hang out with each other on the weekends even. So there is communication going on back and forth like that. So it's not surprising that they would be able to time it the way they have. Your comment now on between the East and West is extremely interesting. One thing that I've been trying to build out with this BRICS currency that we've been hearing so much about and the death of the dollar and de-dollarization is that the BRICS, you know, we're told this multipolar world we're going into is like Russia versus China versus the US, and the US is no longer the hegemon anymore. I kind of take a little bit different view of that, and I view it as the BRICS versus Davos versus Wall Street. So if those are the teams, Wall Street, Davos, and BRICS, BlackRock is on Wall Street. So is the SEC. So is Chair Powell. All these people are on the side of Wall Street. So if you kind of look at it from those teams, it starts making a little bit more sense. What do you think of that theory, CK?
Yeah, no, you talked about that theory on one of your previous Bitcoin and Markets podcasts. And yeah. I think it's very compelling. You know, I'm obviously heavily influenced by your specific analysis. So, you know, I don't think that that's a surprise, but it does make sense to think of it as Wall Street versus Davos versus BRICS. And really the US has kind of birthed two of these powers, right? It's kind of like yep. the European power that emerged from, you know, the US's support of it post-World War II. And that has like turned into Davos. And then obviously the US has been the financial center of the world. And the center of that has been Wall Street. So, I mean, it makes sense to me. From a multipolar perspective, anyone who seems to be clued in any way about China sees that China is struggling and in no place to project power. And, you know, this is another thesis of the show is that these new government fiat shitcoins are like they have run out of time. The contrast between Bitcoin is now here. And moving forward, it's Bitcoin and the dollar. It's not, you know, this BRICS currency, you know, it's going to take a lot of work. And you can look at the work that has gone into building Bitcoin's own network effects for the BRICS currency, a BRICS currency, a new BRICS currency, gold backed or not, to have that infrastructure, to have that network.
Yeah, man, I love the way you put that, that the contrast between fiat and Bitcoin is here and it's glaring. Right. And it seems like Larry Fink and others, Gensler, they're putting a spotlight on this, that this is the moment where we are seeing the rise of Bitcoin as a real competitor. And it's crazy that the price has not moved more than it has. Right.
Hey, you know, this is the perfect buying opportunity. This is where there is asymmetric risk to reward. So I fully agree, yeah. You know. My personal take on where we are in Bitcoin is that we're much earlier in the adoption cycle than most people think. People say, if you heard the word crypto, you've adopted Bitcoin. I don't think that that's a fair measurement. I think, you know, my measurement is someone who is either holding their own keys or willingly abstaining from holding their own keys, right? Knowledgeably abstaining, right? So I'm putting my coins on River. I know exactly what I'm getting myself into. Right. Versus, hey, I got my money in my brokerage and oh my God, I got rugged. Like that's a completely different relationship with Bitcoin. So if you look at it from that perspective, we're far less than 1% adoption. So there's a lot more volatility and a lot more up and a lot more education to do before this asymmetry in terms of these systems, you know, I think converges more.
So would you consider a Bitcoin spot ETF as adoption?
I mean, on the network level, it sounds like this BlackRock ETF is constructed in a way where there actually are underlying Bitcoin transactions. Mm-hmm. So to some degree, yes. But if you zoom out, if there's just people only holding that, and I don't think that necessarily directly, you know, it's like almost like hybrid. I would say it's almost like hybrid. The holders of the ETF have absolutely not adopted Bitcoin. But is money flowing into Bitcoin? Is wealth flowing into Bitcoin? Are there more Bitcoin transactions happening? Most likely, yes, that's the case.
Yeah. Very interesting. There was some other breaking news. Should we get into the Ripple stuff real quick?
Yeah, we don't often talk shitcoins, but you know, this is definitely important precedent being set here in US courts. So Ansel, I think more than anything, this is another blow to the SEC and the ability of any of these governments to enforce against, you know, the cornucopia of shitcoins. But Ansel, let's go to you for some facts before I spill it with more of my opinion.
Okay, well, this is going to be just from Joe Carlisari's Twitter feed. He's friend of the show and a lawyer in the space. And so he is kind of analyzing this. He's actually live on Twitter Spaces right now. So after this show, go and listen to Joe on this. But he says the court's ruling in SEC versus Ripple is essentially that it doesn't matter if the XRP token itself is an investment contract. What matters is that the institutional sales were a scheme the court found to be an issue, found to be at issue an unregistered securities offering. So he's delineating that, that it's not that the token, because a lot of people were saying, oh, Ripple is not a security. See, the court said so. But, you know, he's saying here that the case was about the scheme, not necessarily the token. And in the part of the case that matters, the scheme, it was found to be a security. So this is, it's very dense. Of course, we're going to have the legal experts go through this, talk on Twitter Spaces, talk it out, maybe write some stuff up for it. So we, the plebs, can just read it and see what the SEC is saying. But yes, this is a big day in the history of, I guess, the SEC and Bitcoin, because Ripple is an obvious scam. And if it isn't considered a scam, an unregistered security by the SEC, I don't think anything will be. So that is my update. Any comments on that?
I'm curious what you think. Are they saying that, I guess, based on what you're seeing, is this actually a win for Ripple or
no?
Because it seems like on social media, it's being marketed as if it's a win for Ripple. And obviously the Ripple's price or XRP's price shot up after this ruling, but it doesn't actually sound like it was a win. It sounds like XRP is not a security on a technical basis, and then everything that you did with it is a security, which sounds pretty damning. So, I mean, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not that smart, but, you know, does that sound like accurate based on what Joe is saying?
Yeah. It's the scheme itself of the initial launch was a securities offering. So all of these tokens were securities. And Ripple and Brad Garlinghouse, they're all guilty of securities fraud. So I think it's pretty damning for Ripple.
So what happens next if they don't appeal? I mean, like, what's the next steps? Or is the SEC going to appeal and try to go further? I'm just kind of curious, like, what happens next year?
Well, that's a good point. I think this was a summary judgment. And again, I'm not a lawyer, but a summary judgment is when you're filing motions in a case and one side asks the judge to make an initial judgment based on the evidence that has been provided. So it's not like the whole court case has gone through yet. That still could take another year or two. It's just a summary judgment where, and most likely summary judgments are how the case is going to turn out. At least that's what Joe Carlisari is saying. So this is a big sign that the court will eventually find in this manner. But yeah, so.
Got it. Well, hey, neither of us are lawyers. Thank you for Joe for breaking this down. Highly recommend everyone who's interested in learning more about this to check it out. My main takeaway here is that offering unregulated securities, probably not a good move. But with that being said, if you make enough money doing it, the SEC is too incompetent to actually force your hand on it. And you might be able to blackball them in court and drag it out. And if your sales are high enough, you know, the fees might just be a slap on the wrist. So not encouraging anything here, but, you know, I do want to call out the SEC and other enforcement agencies, like, you're ineffective. And maybe you're supposed to be enforcing in hindsight and creating, you know, precedent for the future, but I haven't seen much consumer protection in the last 8 or 10 years in crypto. And, you know, I think that this, whether the SEC wins or lose the narrative here, whether they win or lose the court case, you know, the fact that we're still dealing with Ripple, like the original scam security, it just shows how far behind they are.
Yeah, great points. If you're going to launch a scam, make sure you get over a billion, then you're safe.
EOS proved that, right? Block one.
Yeah. What's the saying that when you owe someone $10,000, it's your problem? when you owe someone $10 billion, it's their problem or something like that. So just make sure your scam is big enough. But anyway.
Bitcoin Amsterdam was the biggest European Bitcoin event in history, held from October 12th to the 14th, offering 6 different on-site locations and 3 fully programmed stages. We are absolutely stoked to catapult the European community to the global stage. Tickets are at their lowest prices right now. Lock yours in at b.tc/conference/Amsterdam. That's b.tc/conference/Amsterdam. Introducing the Gatekeepers issue, the Q1 2023 print release from Bitcoin Magazine. The winter editorial serves as both a reminder of the sacrifice whistleblowers have made in the pursuit of truth and the call to arms for a new generation. Order it now from BitcoinMagazine.com. There's a thin line between curation and censorship. There is an even thinner line between moderation and constitutional violation. The Gatekeepers issue explores the liminal space between these nuances, painting the fences worthy of demolition and those deserving respect. Bitcoin Magazine is for all Bitcoiners, the curious, convicted, and the maximalists. Subscribe today for exclusive interviews and profiles with leading Bitcoiners, actionable insights on the state of the market, breaking news and cultural trends, powerful photos and artwork from the best artists in the world. Don't miss out on this piece of Bitcoin history. Subscribe now at store.bitcoinmagazine.com. Bitcoiners, if you're like me and want to gain a deeper understanding of what's going on within the Bitcoin market and broader macro environment, you need to subscribe to Bitcoin Magazine Pro today. There's both a free and paid version of this daily newsletter where our market analysts Dylan LeClaire and Sam Rule break down what's going on in the market so you don't have to. Subscribe today at BitcoinMagazinePro.com. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Subscribe today at BitcoinMagazinePro.com and embark on a path towards Bitcoin mastery. Get ready to seize every opportunity in the market with Bitcoin Magazine Pro today.
Let's move on to the Bitcoin charts because we haven't really dove into Bitcoin. Let me look at the live chart actually as well. So can we pull that one up? There we go. As you can see, we're in this flag kind of horizontal channel. There is a red dotted line within this channel. We're right around the middle of this. I've been watching this for obviously the whole time. And each time we go past 31,000, there's a big monkey hammer slam back down on the price. So we'll see. I made a tweet a couple days ago when we got monkey hammered down again at 31,000. I was like, man, is this like a bear whale situation where someone just has massive sells going on at 31,000? We did pass that this morning with all of this breaking news, but again, we are back down below 31,000 at 30,900 right now. So yeah, what are your thoughts on the price here? This is a bullish pattern. The likelihood of breaking upward is much higher than breaking down out of this. But what are your thoughts, CK?
Yeah, I don't have a whole lot of good stuff to say. I feel like I've been bearish / undecided, you know, for the past 2 months. At the same time, it's hard not to be bullish, right? So I think the most important thing is that we continue to march upwards. The longer that we stay in consolidation, in my opinion, you know, kind of gives people the opportunity to get spooked. And we're still in the part of like the quote unquote cycle where there's definitely room to go back down. I don't think we're in full bull mode yet. So I don't know. I kind of remain to be, you know, 60% short-term bullish, 40% short-term bearish, but you know, this is a bullish pattern, and there's a lot of things that we're going to get into that I think are very bullish for Bitcoin. There's been a lot of things very bullish for Bitcoin for a long time. You know, we didn't really talk about Larry Fink's comments being really a paradigm shift in the way that institutions can talk about Bitcoin. So that's something that is very, very bullish. So, you know, we'll see what the immediate price action looks like. You know, this could be a BART, you know, but it could be the beginning of the next bull, where we're obviously, you know, just going up again. So I would say like we're probably at that crossroads right now, and you know, we'll see which direction we're going to go.
Yeah, I mean, good sober comments there. I think it could go either direction, but the time is running short. I think there needs to be a move one way or the other within a short period of time. Like it could go sideways, of course, but It feels like there's so much news happening that this there's so little volatility. I saw that the B bands on the daily are like at historic tightness. Like there's only been two or three times in history that they
needs to go one way or the other when it's that tight.
Yep. So we'll see. We'll see. But I do have some other little charts here.
Before we get into this chart, we didn't opine that much on Larry Fink. Do we want to spend any time on that while we're at the chart?
We can. Yeah, sure. It's Nolan and I talked about it. We played it last week, that clip. And what I've said about it was that he hit every single like narrative for Bitcoin. He hit on that it is digital gold, that it's an international asset, you know, a borderless asset. And he said it represented hope. So really the only thing, and it's an inflation hedge. So like the only thing that he missed was, I guess that it's also a deflation hedge and that it is trusted third parties. You know, that's what it's trying to disintermediate is trusted third parties. And he didn't touch on that. But overall, I agree. It's very bullish shift in the entire narrative from the major institutions. Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah, I would say that's the most important thing to me. Like what he said has been what we've been saying for the past 6, 7, 8, for some Bitcoiners, 10 years. Those are the real goats out there, the real OGs. But what is more important is big asset manager said Bitcoin. And I think that is de-risking it. And I can't tell you how many conversations I've had. And, you know, I like to bring in that anecdotal kind of evidence to the show, but I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with new Bitcoiners I've interacted with. And their story sounds so familiar. Hey, I was in software. I exited these companies. I work in networking. I want to go full-time Bitcoin. I'm going full-time Bitcoin, right? And we're now starting to see, you know, tech talent starting to really not just say, hey, I'm interested in this space, but I want to go full-time Bitcoin. I am dedicating the rest of my career to Bitcoin. And I think that there's a similar thing that happened during the dot-com era where people said, I'm committing my career to the internet. I'm committing my career to move into this new sector. And that to me, that's the most bullish thing. And I think big asset manager Larry Fink saying Bitcoin on camera is almost like that social indication.
Yeah. And Bitcoin, not as rat poison, but Bitcoin as hope and an international asset. So yeah, exactly. Okay. Let's go into, you're talking about the big institutional stuff. Let's actually go to some of the inflows that we see from these big like investment houses and stuff. So if we go to the next slide, please. This is from CoinShares. They put out a weekly report and these are inflows by week. Blue is Bitcoin, and you can see the last 3 weeks it has been extremely positive, and there's almost no other thing, nothing else that is getting any sort of inflows at all. If we go to the next slide, it breaks it down by table and inflows by asset. Bitcoin, I think that's 290 million, where Ethereum is minus 63 million. So that's by asset. And then by country, I thought this was interesting that the US is up here at $285 million of inflows. And Germany is bringing up the next spot at $212 million in inflows year to date. So very interesting developments here from inflow side of the house. This looks like US and Europe, big inflows, mainly into Bitcoin, and everything else is kind of losing in this, you know, I guess, competition for investment capital. CK, any comments on these charts?
I mean, again, the most important reason why it was important to have both Bitcoin and shitcoin is for the contrast. And there was a lot of confusion and a lot of education, but it seems as though, once again, Bitcoin is differentiating itself in a huge way. And when you see the inflows into Bitcoin as opposed to Ethereum, I think that is the most telling, because Ethereum really is the most legitimate shitcoin. There's a lot of things wrong with it, but in terms of like fundamentals, everything else is just straight noise. Like Ethereum really is the only one that actually has the ability to capture a massive market and has massive kind of market share. And to see Bitcoin, you know, differentiate itself and continue to thrive against that competitor, I think is extremely bullish for Bitcoin.
Yeah, on that table, they had a short Bitcoin interest, and it had more. It had $58 million of inflows, where Ethereum had negative 63. So that even short Bitcoin interest is more than the Ethereum interest, which I think is interesting.
I mean, and really, I would say like this year has been kind of like the year where it's like, oh, Bitcoin can shitcoin too. And I'm not like, I don't actually like shitcoining, but if like the shitcoiners, that's all they had, then, you know, sweep the leg, you know, they're done.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and this also puts into context the Bitcoin dominance index. It's still at only like 52% or something when you just saw those inflows where it's more than 100% of the inflows into the space are going into Bitcoin. You know?
Well, and like, let me just kind of break down the Bitcoin dominance index in a different way. The Bitcoin dominance index is a fantastic way, and it's only good at showing you one thing, and that is how good Bitcoin is against the other side, which is literally unlimited printing. Like, how many shitcoins got invented last month? How many shitcoins got invented the month before that? How about the month before that? And yet, despite that, despite, you know, all the poor accounting against those and all of the manipulation about market cap and printing and, you know, liquid market and blah, 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 blah. Despite all of that, like literally the deck being stacked so heavily against Bitcoin, it's still increasing in dominance. Like that is the biggest testament of what that metric actually says. There's no other signal that you can actually, you know, derived from it. So, you know, the rest, like the metric is complete garbage, other than despite it being complete garbage and the deck being stacked completely against Bitcoin, numbers still go up in Bitcoin's favor. That's all you have to say.
Yeah. Oh man. Great comments. We missed you here, CK, on the show. So, okay. That's all I have for Bitcoin price. What should we roll into CPI? What do you think?
Let's do it. You are the guru of CPI. So break it down for us, Ansel.
All right. So what you're seeing here on the screen is the year over year CPI. I guess I should have started with the month over month, but yeah. So CPI just came out yesterday. I did live stream it with Bitcoin and Markets. I was, you know, on the live stream at 8:30 in the morning when it dropped, and I had my initial reaction. For it was forecast by all the, you know, I guess, investment professionals out there, that they were estimating it to come in month over month at 0.3%. It came in month over month, 0.2%. They were estimating year over year to be at 3.1, and it came in at 3%, actually just under 3% at 2.97%, rounded up to 3%. But you can see this is the year over year chart on the screen, and if that's not transitory, I don't know what is. If you go to the next slide, you can see the month over month. And the month that got dropped from this, the reason why we went from 4% year over year all the way to 3% in 1 month is because that the highest point on this chart is the one that fell off. So we replaced a 1.2% month over month with a 0.2% month over month. So that was a 1% decline. And yeah, CK, any thoughts on the CPI numbers?
I don't have huge thoughts. I mean, other than you've been calling it right the whole time. And I'm just kind of curious, like, do you feel vindicated and where do we go from here?
Well, a little bit. Yes, a little bit. And I've seen a lot of...
Hey, you got to do a victory lap, Ansel. Yeah, come on, man.
Yeah, I've seen people on Twitter. And, you know, because I've been in the transitory camp the whole time, and I saw some people on Twitter saying, oh, the transitory people are taking a lap, a victory lap. And but that is so farcical because the blah, 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 X, Y, Z. No, I mean, if people got it right, you should give them the credit. And if you got it wrong, you should be able to say you got it wrong. And I've been pulling up some old CPI tweets from like 2021 and 2022. And seeing how people like Luke Grohman and others responded to me. And I've been posting those in my Telegram chat because everybody was talking about 8, 10, 15% inflation, runaway inflation, hyperinflation. And it was Jeff Schneider pretty much and myself. We're sitting here saying, no, this is going to be transitory. Nothing has changed. Like, this is a supply shock plus a war in Europe. Okay. You had a supply shock and war in Europe, and we got to 9% inflation or 9% CPI. Like, that's CPI. That's not.
Prices went up by 9%.
Yeah.
Was that 100% created by money printing? Isn't that an insane connection that everyone seems to think is just like how the world works?
Yeah.
Price go up, money got printed. That's how it works. That's the only way that prices can go up.
Well, yeah,
there is no other mechanism for prices to go up, Ansel.
It's because they call everything inflation. People call every damn thing inflation, and then they
language
have to,
is so important, man.
They have to qualify it with, oh, we're talking about price inflation. We're talking about asset inflation. We're talking about supply inflation. We're talking about, you know, just blah, 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 blah. Everything is inflation. And that is why we get confused. But anyway, I have some more charts on this. If we go to the next slide, that's slide number 6. This is broken down. So one of the big lagging indicators in CPI is shelter. And that's the red line there. And then the rest of the index, which is, so everything X shelter is in the blue line. Shelter is supposed to be lagging. And what do we see? We saw middle of last year, everything else came down. Shelter continued to go higher. Now shelter is coming around as everything else is still low and maybe going lower. So this is a recipe for continued deceleration, if not outright contraction in prices. 70% of this CPI increase was from the shelter component. And you can see that's coming down pretty quickly here. If we go to the next slide, these are ones that I picked up from Joe Consorti at the Bitcoin Layer. So shout out to him. You can follow him, find him on Twitter. Nick Batia's outfit there at the Bitcoin Layer. These are great charts. But this is, the white is the PPI, so producer prices. And the blue is the consumer prices. And we've talked about it here on the show before that producer prices tend to lead consumer prices, right? That makes sense that the suppliers will pay a price and they'll pass that on to the consumer at the end. So the CPI is actually lagged by 6 months on this chart to show that lag between the producer prices and the consumer prices. And look at this, producer prices are under 2% and CPI is well on its way there as well. If we go to the next slide, stop me whenever you want, CK.
No, keep rolling.
Okay, next slide here is consumer credit, again from Joe Consorti. And this is a huge number, guys, because money in a credit-based system like we have today, money is printed when banks make loans. No other source of money printing is important. This is the only source of money printing that you have to worry yourself about. And it came in this last month. Let's see, May is the most recent month that they have on here. At $7 billion increase, they were expecting 20 and they got 7. And it's not necessarily that that is still a positive number because you have to think about how much is getting paid off, right? So you might have a net decrease in credit if the, you know, I guess the absolute change is still a little bit up like this $7 billion. But if $10 billion was paid off, you'd have a decrease in credit, and that is outright deflation. That's a reduction in the supply of money. And the last chart that I have here from Joe Consorti is supply chain pressures. And again, this is just a fantastic chart because it shows that pretty much this is the easiest or the cheapest supply chain that we've had going back. I mean, it was tied here back in, looks like about 2008, 2009, but all of those supply chain pressures are gone now. This is very, very disinflationary or outright deflationary. So CK, any thoughts on these charts from Joe Consorti?
Sorry, I was trying to find the unmute button. No, I mean, I think you broke it down really well. And I think the biggest thing to point out here is that these kind of more mainstream analysts that were screaming inflation, Joe was one of them. I love the guy, smart young man. You know, even now he cannot deny that the economy is operating in a different way. And this is where I think, you know, we have been so accurate about the nature of the dollar system on this show. And that's what is so important is that if you actually, from first principles, understand the nature of the dollar system, then you can actually make accurate predictions about what is going to transpire. And I think that Ansel has been one of the best analysts on the planet speaking English, talking about this on the internet. So I'm thankful that he's been here for the last 2 years, kind of helping us navigate the craziness that is, you know, the global macro economy. But I mean, even though screaming inflation cannot deny the facts.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been fun to watch the copium from the inflationista side of the house. Where I think it's going in the near term is, again, I think end of Q3 is when that's a seasonal time of year where most crises happen. End of Q1 is second most, and we saw the Silicon Valley.
Hey, what happened end of Q3 in, yeah, you're just hitting that. What happened in end of Q3 of 2022? And so you're saying end of Q3 is going to be fireworks. What happened? You're saying Signature, Silvergate, who else?
Yeah, well, end of Q3.
That was Q1, I guess. It was when all those banks busted, but end of Q3.
Yeah, well, end of Q3, you could go back to July, which would be the beginning of Q3 in 2022, is when it hit the brick wall for CPI. But if you go back to 2019, that's when the repo rumble happened. If you go back to 2008, it was Bear Stearns happened in September 1987. You know, all of these things happen. Even going back to 1929 was, you know, in October. So end of Q3 is when all of these stresses in the system come to a head. And so that's what I'm kind of expecting, is that will be the lowest in the CPI actually. We'll continue to see the next couple months drop, maybe even going negative on the month over month. And then we will be under 2% by the end of the year. Most likely there is a possibility that we'll be at zero. So yeah, that's what I'm seeing.
All right. Well, what does that do to the narrative? And what does that mean for rates?
Oh man. Well, you know, I've been talking about a pivot for a long time, and they finally got a pause. A lot of people are thinking that there's going to be one or two more hikes out of the Federal Reserve a couple weeks. I think it's in 2 weeks is when the next FOMC meeting is. Most likely there will be a hike in that meeting, but the odds changed drastically yesterday. I bet the odds got cut in half of a rate hike yesterday. So we'll see. And by the end of Q3, we'll probably have more bank failures, you know, more things like that, where the Fed could almost cut by then. Jeff Schneider, great analyst on yield curves and everything from Eurodollar as well as Treasury curves, saying that the time is nigh, right? That we're going to start cutting rates. So the Fed is going to be forced to cut. They really follow the market. They followed it all the way up. They're going to follow it all the way down. And when they start pivoting and when they actually start going down, we're going to see CPI crash. So if we're already at 3%, we could see CPI go to zero.
I mean, wild stuff. It'd be insane to see that when probably exactly 1 year ago, people were still really screaming inflation is going to the moon. Ansel, let's pivot over to some macro charts. I know we want to talk about some of these fiat charts. Let's jump into it.
Well, the next one I still have, this is still kind of on the topic of CPI. Okay. So
sorry, I didn't mean to jump ahead.
No, that's fine. These are break evens. So a lot of people were like, how, you know, they might say, how do you know that, or how did you know it's going to be transitory? Well, we can look at inflation expectations. It's pretty darn easy. And these are the 5-year and the 10-year break even. It didn't really get all that high. It looks like the 5-year got to about, I think, 3.2 or 3.3% has come back down. I also highlighted in the red boxes where there was an inversion. So you would expect the 5-year to be under the 10-year, but this top back in, when is that, 2006 or so, is when we saw an inversion, and then we saw an inversion this whole time. So that's signaling that this is not a healthy rally. This is not a sustainable rally. This is some sort of market distortion that we're seeing right now. And so it's very easy when you look at these type of numbers, the break-evens, that this was going to be transitory all along. If we go to the next slide, this is also break evens, but I added in the 30-year break even. And you can see when it's healthy, the 30-year is above the 10 and the 10 is above the 5. When we had this high CPI time, we had the 5 all the way up at the top, then the 10, then the 30. And just recently now we've seen a inversion. So it flattened out, and now it's actually sloped properly now, with the 5 barely below the 10 and the 10 barely below the 30. So what does this mean? A lot of people are talking about the yield curve inversions for the treasury market, and like the 10 and 2 or the 10 and the 3 month, and the recession follows when that inversion gets corrected. You know, like the inversion is saying something's wrong, but when the inversion goes away is actually when the recession comes. Now we can look at this kind of break-even analysis here as well from the break-evens and say, well, it's uninverted now. So this could be signaling when that the treasury curve is going to become uninverted, and then we're going to get a recession very soon by the end of Q3.
So you've been kind of saying, and it's been funny to hear the narrative adjust from it's going to be a hard landing, things are going to be horrible, inflation tripping to the sky. You know, you were kind of saying, you know, I think your calculation was like 50% chance of a light recession, 25 chance of a tough recession, 25 chance of, you know, not a recession, just things continue as normal. I guess talk to us about like the timing and how you can kind of make those calculations on your end. Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking of an official recession, you know, by the National Bureau of Economic Research. They say it has to be 2 consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth, real GDP growth, plus a few other factors like unemployment. There's this, you know, there's a few other things. And that was one that people were hollering about, because we actually had 2 negative quarters of GDP growth. When was that? Back in?
That was 22.
And they didn't label it a recession because there wasn't all these other things ticked, all these other boxes checked. Europe is different. They just do straight up 2 quarters of negative GDP growth. That's why they are in an official recession right now. But the big thing is real GDP. And with real GDP, you take into account inflation or CPI, PCE deflator, however you want to measure that, the price component. And if you have bad economic times and your economy is actually crashing, say you go down negative 10%, but your prices also drop 10% or 9%, it's like a race to the bottom to see which will your real GDP be positive or negative. So that's why I was arguing the whole time that this is going to feel very bad. It's going to feel like a very bad recession, but officially it's not going to be, because CPI is coming down as rapidly as growth is coming down. So does that make sense, CK?
No, I think it does make a lot of sense. Yeah, I know we don't have too much time. So do you want any more comments on CPI, or should we jump over to talking about some of this fiat?
Yeah, let's talk about the dollar here, because we have the dollar and then we have Lummis, her bill that came out today. So let's go to the next slide, slide number 12, please. This is the DXY, and on the bottom is the RSI. So that is the relative strength indicator. And you can see, if you take our heads away, Tino, we have that red circle is oversold on the daily. It's the first time it has been oversold actually since 2021. So this looks like it could be getting towards a bottom, but this move in the dollar has surprised me. I have been one of the, I guess, biggest strong dollar advocates in the Bitcoin space. Even though I'm a Bitcoiner, I have been a strong dollar advocate. So yeah, this move has surprised me. If we go to the next slide, then we could see this a little bit better. There, yeah, we can see a little bit better there. All the way back to 2020, actually, December of 2020 is the last time we had an oversold condition on the daily for the DXY. What could be causing this? Well, I have the next slide is the Chinese yuan. We have been talking about this with Nolan here on the show the last few weeks, and it looked like it was going to continue to get weaker. This is the CNY versus the dollar. And it's inverted. So it's, as it's going down, it's actually getting weaker, unlike sometimes on the show when I've showed it the other direction. But just recently, it's been all hands on deck over there in China to stop the precipitous decline in the yuan. And it has turned around dramatically. Now, CNY is not in the basket for DXY, but we can see that there is something going on here. It is a major international 4X cross. So what is going on with the US dollar Chinese yuan is going to be important for the dollar around the world. If we go to the next slide, we do get to a...
Returning back to levels not seen since last June.
Yeah. If we look at this one, this is the broad dollar index. So this does include the Chinese yuan. I think it might be like 9% of this index here. And we don't see the precipitous decline that we see in the DXY. Perhaps there is a data lag, but I don't think so. I think this is real-time data. So that is interesting that the broad dollar index does not show the same thing that the DXY does. And the last chart I have here for the dollar is versus Bitcoin. And you can see there's an obvious indirect relationship here. You know, as the DXY is going up, Bitcoin is going down and vice versa. However, what I would like to point out in this chart is that there, if you go from the beginning to the end, they're both going up over time. So the dollar is getting stronger as Bitcoin is being monetized. So we kind of tie this back to the beginning of the show, and we see that, like you were talking about, this is a battle between the dollar and Bitcoin. CK, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, Dino, you want to go back to us? Perfect. Yeah, I mean, that's the story of this show, is we are trying to say there's no BRICS shitcoin, there's no Euro CBDC. That's not going to happen. It's hyperdollarization followed by hyperbitcoinization, and that's the most important chart that you can show is, yes, there's this dance between Bitcoin and the dollar. One goes up, one goes down, but they're both going up as they take over the world economy.
Yeah, and where is all this Bitcoin hype coming from right now? It's coming from American-based firms, American-based ETF products,
American-based media companies.
Media companies, miners, Riot.
American-based miners, yeah.
Riot just had that big investment from Vanguard. So this is really the whole attention for Bitcoin is, I think, this is a play. It is a dance, like you're saying. It is a dance between the dollar and Bitcoin. And it is just fun. It's a fun time to be alive, wouldn't you say?
Oh, my God. We live in most interesting times, so that can have some danger, but it's definitely not boring.
Absolutely. Okay, last topic, CK, is the Lummis bill.
Politics, our queen.
Have you had a chance to look into what people are saying about it out there or anything?
No, I have been just playing catch up all day, so educate me, sir, and I will try to give my uneducated opinion afterwards.
All right. Well, I tried to read through this bill. I think I got to like page 60 or something like that. And it is, of course, like all congressional, you know, all laws that are all these bills, they're just written in all this gobbledygook language. And it's really hard to piece out what they're saying. But what I did pull out with help from Bitcoin Twitter, is that the crypto asset intermediary, that's what they're calling exchanges, crypto asset intermediary, and they will be regulated by the CFTC and not the SEC. So they're trying to take that away from the SEC. The crypto assets, of course, I hate these terms, everything crypto or crypto asset. Crypto asset is one of the worst terms ever created for these things. But crypto asset is to become a commodity unless it is one of these four things: a debt or equity interest in that entity, liquidation rights with respect to that entity, an entitlement to an interest or dividend payment from that entity, or this is the kicker, any other financial interest in that entity. So I think, of course, all these shitcoins, they fall into this definition, even though it was written kind of to try to, I think, all the existing crypto assets out there. So CK. Oh, and then the last thing they have on here is stable coins would be regulated and required to be full reserve and have transparency in their reserves. So CK, what are your thoughts on this?
I mean, this is pretty similar to other bills that she has put forward. I personally think that the idea of coming up with a new regulatory agency for Bitcoin and crypto assets, whatever that means, and coming up with a term and in a category that is crypto assets is just not the right way. It's just not the right way. It seems as though that was the political strategy of the coin centers, is like defend all blockchain. That's how you help Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And, you know, I really do think like folks like the Bitcoin Policy Institute, they're a lot more aligned with what makes sense, which is just focus on Bitcoin. Like there are already regulatory, very poorly run and ineffective regulatory agencies that are supposed to regulate securities, which literally all of these things that aren't Bitcoin are. And if it's not a security, it's a digital commodity. I think that that has been something that people have accepted. So what's the need to create a new category? What's more important to me is protect proof of work, protect people's rights to write code, protect people to be able to write open source code and contribute to Bitcoin. That's what, you know, if a lawmaker wants to create laws that are helpful, like that's much more helpful than all of this unnecessary complexity that seems to be introduced by this law.
That reminds me, I do remember one thing from the bill is that taxes for miners. So miners were taxed as income, right? Or the Bitcoin that they mined was income and taxed at the income tax rate. But this bill would exempt them from income tax until they dispose of the Bitcoin. So they can hold it in their treasury for a year, two, five. It's only when they sell it, then do they owe tax on it. So I thought that was
That's better. Yeah. I mean, less taxes for everyone. I don't know the mechanics of that. And, you know, if miners are being treated unfairly, but, you know, I'm down to make mining more profitable in America. That's the opposite of what Joe Biden was trying to do just a few months ago.
Yeah, I think that the crypto asset intermediary and the crypto asset stuff is not going to go very far. The stablecoin, though, I think that is probably going to be maybe taken out and put into its own sort of bill because there is a lot of appetite, I think, right now to regulate stablecoins and bring them into the fold where other countries are trying to do the CBDC route, the digital euro or whatever. We already have a digital dollar and we have a tokenized dollar, which is Tether. So just bring Tether into the fold. And I think there is a lot of appetite for that. So that along with this minor tax, I think are two kind of good things in the bill, but the crypto asset whole thing that just needs to be shelved for a while.
Yeah. I mean, hey, I get the stablecoin thing. And honestly, I'm thankful for the stablecoin thing because regulators are really freaking focused on stablecoins and not Bitcoin. So I'm happy about that. Regulate the dollar tokens, please regulate them, figure it out. I guarantee you some cypherpunk hacker is going to continue to build stuff that's outside of your purview. And that is all going to be good for Bitcoin. You know, my whole thesis here is the stable coins, the shit coins, the narrative, all of that is just confusion, which benefits Bitcoin in the long run. It protects Bitcoin from regulatory attacks. It exposes the incompetence of these agencies and the corruption of these politicians. So let's keep it going. Let's keep it going. In terms of regulating these stable coins, we'll see how long it takes. You know, I'm starting to believe they won't regulate these stable coins till hyper Bitcoinization is here because they're taking so damn long. So let's see if they can make moves there. And if they can fix things up for miners in America, that's probably good for America. But with that being said, let's also distribute some freaking hash here. So let's get some hash in other parts of the world. That's not something we can centrally plan. It's just going to happen by itself. But yeah, I mean, hey, I know we're pretty close to the end of time, so I will shut up. Ansel, I want to give you the last word and then we can wrap the show up for today.
Yeah, just when you were talking there, I got the idea that, you know, by regulating stable coins, they will be putting pressure on the scams anyway. Because the stable coins, they are used in a lot of the DeFi. They're used in a lot of the exchanges, you know, to send back and forth to buy these shit coins. So by regulating the stable coins, you can also have a pretty big effect on regulating scams, the ability for scams to grow.
Then they'll just start using Bitcoin again. Bitcoin will be the reserve asset of the scams once again. Ansel, thanks so much for coming on the show. Thank you so much for all of the incredible analysis that you bring. I'm happy to be back. It's been a long time, but I have been enjoying the shows that you and Nolan have been putting together. Honestly, my favorite duo. But y'all, Bitcoin Amsterdam 2023, October 12th to the 13th. Come see me there. And then, hey, consider Bitcoin Nashville 2024. It's a little bit more than a year away, a year and 12 days away from now. But it's still never too early to get a ticket and start getting excited about the biggest event in the world for Bitcoin. Y'all, we'll catch you later. Peace.
What is up, audio listeners? Thank you for enjoying another episode of FedWatch. Down in the show notes, you will find all the appropriate links to our social media, the original version of this podcast, and community links. Also, check out bitcoinandmarkets.com, where I put out a free weekly newsletter every Friday. And there you can also help support the show by signing up to become a paid member. See you next time.
Over the last 5 years, the Bitcoin Conference has become the world's largest gathering of Bitcoiners. From breaking announcements and international media coverage to countless meaningful talks by thought leaders and industry innovators, we are excited to continue our drive for global hyper-Bitcoinization. From July 25th to the 27th, 2024, we'll be taking the Bitcoin Conference to the city of music and freedom, Nashville, Tennessee. Join thousands of attendees for countless opportunities to learn, engage, and network across 3 days of pure Bitcoin signal. Get your tickets now for the best price at b.tc/conference. You are not going to want to miss what Nashville has in store. My fellow plebs, Bitcoin Magazine is headed back to Amsterdam in 2023. We're returning to Westergaas to build on this historic success and continue our mission of global hyper-Bitcoinization. Bitcoin Amsterdam was the biggest European Bitcoin event in history, held from October 12th to the 14th at Westergaas Event Forum, offering 6 different on-site locations and 3 fully programmed stages. We are absolutely stoked to catapult the European community to the global stage. Tickets are at their lowest prices right now. Lock yours in at b.tc/conference/Amsterdam. That's b.tc/conference/Amsterdam.